Welcome to This Week in Money. I'm Jim Goddard. Today, Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com runs down the major markets. He says November was a stellar month, with the markets rising 9%. He says the Canadian dollar is showing some life and gold is enjoying its seasonal popularity. Publisher of the book, The Money Bubble, John Rubino, weighs in on gold, silver, housing bubbles, mystery diseases in China, and why you might want to hold off on buying an e-bike right now. Checking in from San Francisco, Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com, says American consumers are still spending like crazy. And while many are reaching their credit limits, there's no sign of a recession yet. He's worried, though, that rents are going up faster than pay raises. We'll talk to Ross Clark right after this.
Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
Welcome to This Week in Money, the source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com, where you'll find insightful market commentary and timely technical analysis. You can find him on X at Charts by Ross. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Great time to be with you, Jim.
Ross, how would you describe what happened on the stock markets and how did we end the month?
Well, this was, the month of November is historically the second best month of the year. Everybody likes to think about the Santa Claus rally, and yes, December will historically be a good month. You get a bit more of a chop during December, but November was up pretty much 9% across the board on most of the indices, and, you know, everybody thinks that was a pretty exciting run, but it's because we had such chop right from the spring right through until October. But if we look back historically, that November is typically a 9 to 17% month on the upside. So this was not out of the norm. The rally around Thanksgiving was there as well. Not of the magnitude that we've seen in the last few years, but it was pretty buoyant. And then, you know, the big thing that we've had out here is that interest rates, however everybody's been talking about the high rates, the fact is that rates have been coming down now for the better part of a month. We've been looking at the U.S. 10 and 20 and 30-year bond yields with targets up around 5%. We got right up there. We saw the big upside overbought signals in the yields. On the other side of the coin, the bond market was giving us the strongest buy signals that we've had in two decades. And we've just had a great rally off the bottom in the bonds. And these bond yields now have dropped from 5% down to about 4.40, which is pretty significant. And looks as though a reasonable target is going to be closer to 4% on this break. So I think there's going to be a little bit of relief for those who might be looking to renew the mortgages in the next couple of months. You know, we've got the Fed out there saying that they're data dependent. You know, are we staying up higher for longer in rates or not? Well, the fact is that, you know, when we take a look at the charts, we're data dependent too. And what we've seen is that rates are rolling. And for that, it's been a big incentive for a lot of the markets.
What's going on with gold?
Well, there's one that has clearly managed to have the type of move you'd expect to see. If you overlay bond yields and prices with the gold market, you know, you see that if you get the inflation-adjusted rates on the interest rates, that the gold market will rally well when rates are coming back down, because there's no competitive edge then with the bond yields. versus gold, which doesn't have a yield. And also what you end up with is the U.S. dollar, as rates start to subside down in the States, the dollar comes under some pressure. And so if you're pricing things in dollars like we do in gold, most people do, at least in North America, then your gold price is going to come to life. And you know, the piece that we put out a couple of weeks ago looking at the seasonality in gold is that you find a good low historically in the last 10 weeks of the year, and what you look for is an oversold condition and then a rally that will last at least into the new year. Sometimes it's topped out in the first week or two, but in most cases, the rally is going to be 47 calendar or trading days or more. And as of this week, we finished up at all-time highs in gold, and we're only 15 days into this run. So there's a lot of potential in here as far as we're concerned on the upside. The pattern for the last 3 or 4 years here has been a consolidation. That's the classic that you see prior to a breakout. And, you know, we've got enough, energy stored within this pattern to drive us for quite a while. Got some good price objectives on the upside. We've published those for these subscribers. And we should have a few good entry points on pullbacks along the way. But for now, we're enjoying the run.
What's going on with crude?
Crude oil in selling off into this consolidation area in the $72 to $79 range for the better part of the last couple of weeks now. We've got a pattern here that shows a pretty much completed drop from the seasonal high in the last couple of months down to what would normally be the seasonal low in November, December. And the price pattern is such that as of this Friday, we've completed the necessary amount on the downside. And what we'll be looking for is a base in here. Ideally, you want to see we closed off the week around 74.40. Ideally, we'd like to see it break just a little bit more and do a bit of a clean out of the support underneath the market and that type of undercut followed by what we would call a spring back above the point of previous support. That then could be the catalyst for the seasonal run on the upside. And historically, once this thing turns, you can be looking for movements into February and ideally into April. So there's pretty good potential, I think, here. You've got to have a little bit of perseverance waiting for this to come into play. But I think we're going to have some very nice entry points in the crude oil market within the next couple of weeks.
Ross, anything happening with the U.S. and Canadian dollars?
Well, the Canadian dollar, you know, it was, 3 weeks ago now that the commitment of traders numbers just flashed a big buy signal as far as the Canadian dollar was concerned. And, you know, we've rallied now from 72 to 74 cents. So for a currency like this one, that's been pretty darn good. And at this point, I don't see any lid on the top of this one. So we just let it run until we start to see some divergences. And the type of thing we would look for is to see if it's underperforming the other the commodity related items such as the agricultural side or the oil market. And as of this week, with the move higher, while the oil market is still having trouble finding its bottom, that's a pretty good bias in the Canadian. So you know, I was bearish for quite a while in Canadian, but for the last few weeks we've had the action that you would expect to see coming off those COT numbers. So there's a lot of people short out there, and it's time for them to be looking to get squeezed a bit.
Ross, thank you so much for the update.
Good to be with you, Jim.
My guest has been Ross Clark from chartsandmarkets.com. Find him on X at Charts by Ross. Coming up, John Rubino, next on This Week in Money.
Always consult your investment professional before making any investment decision. Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com. This Week in Money is archived online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. He founded the website DollarCollapse.com. He's speaking to us from Port Angeles, Washington. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Hey, Jim.
John, gold and silver are having a nice run. What's behind it? Seasonality, the recent Fed pause, geopolitics, the U.S. dollar, or a combination of those things and other stuff?
There's a bunch of things going on that are positive for gold right now, which makes this an interesting time. And you mentioned seasonality, and this is the beginning of the strong 3 or 4 months that gold has each year. Because of Asian buying, because they have their weddings in the spring and they like to give gold and silver jewelry at weddings. And so the jewelers are all out there buying their inventory right now. That usually gives gold and silver both 3 or 4 nice months, and it's happening again. And the Fed just stopped raising interest rates. And normally the way things work is that when the Fed stops raising rates, everything goes down. But that hasn't happened yet, and we're getting a relief rally in equities and in lots of other things. And so that could be a factor. The gold and silver are going up because they perceive that monetary policy is going to start to get easy from here. Geopolitics, obviously, is crazy. You know, when you're on the verge of multiple world wars, you want to own the safest safe haven possible, and that's gold. And the U.S. dollar got weak on the Fed news, and when the dollar goes down, that usually helps the price of gold. So we've got all this stuff going on right now, and gold is just a whisker away from its all-time high. I don't remember what its all-time high is. It's something like 2070 an ounce, right? Well, it's 2060-something right now. So by the end of the day today, we could see gold at an all-time high in U.S. dollar terms, which is nice. Silver hasn't scaled those heights yet, but it will catch up. If gold continues to go up, silver will go up faster from here on. So good times at last.
Unless what?
Oh no! I said good times at last.
There are
a lot of reasons. There are reasons that it might not work out, and the biggest is that we're going to have an equities bear market, possibly a crash in 2024, and that's usually bad for precious metals too. But it also usually leads central banks to ease, which is in the longer run good for precious metals. So, I wouldn't worry about the squiggles on the way to the massive new bull market that's coming. I would just enjoy what's happening right now. Don't worry about the next few months, and then expect big things in late 2024.
What does higher gold and silver mean for mining company profits and share prices?
So far, it hasn't done much, but the mining stocks are starting to pick up a little steam. And the way this works is that usually you get gold going up first, and the miners are traumatized because of the recent bear market, and it takes a while for money to come back in. People feel burned. They don't want to own any more mining stocks because they just lost 40% on their Newmont or whatever. So it takes a little while. But once that train leaves the station, it becomes a spectacular run because the gold and silver miners taken together are very small in terms of overall market cap combined. So it doesn't take a lot of generalist money coming from outside because they're attracted to the momentum to really turbocharge the stocks. So if, let's say, gold sustained its breakthrough from resistance at 2000, and continues to go up for a while. Let's say 2,500
becomes the next target in a lot of people's minds, well, you'll see panic buying of gold and silver miners at that point. And I don't think we're that far from that. You know, could easily, let's say gold spikes through 2100, then all the technicians are going to say, well, that's it for resistance until 2500. So it's off to the races. So you get momentum buying at that point. So anyhow, I think gold and silver miners obviously depend on the underlying metals, but if the metals have a nice run here, the miners will end up having an even better run.
Is housing a bubble that will eventually burst?
Oh, yeah. This is the biggest housing bubble in U.S. history. It doesn't feel like it, huh? Because the one in the previous decade was a lot more spectacular. You know, it was much more noticeable what was happening in the housing market. But the fact is that home prices in the U.S. have gone up to the point where affordability is the worst it's ever been. In other words, it's harder today for the average American to buy the average American house than it's ever been. So you combine insanely high prices with mortgage rates that have spiked, even with interest rates going down a little bit lately, mortgage rates are still around 7%. So that puts the vast majority of houses out of the reach of the vast majority of would-be buyers. In that kind of a situation, prices have to come down dramatically in order to bring things back into balance. So let's say house prices have to go down by 40%. Well, that is a crisis in the housing industry. That constitutes a crash, and it'll put all kinds of related entities out of business. And I think that's the highest probability scenario for the year ahead. So yeah, housing is going to burst. And it might not take too long unless interest rates plunge from here. If interest rates stay around current levels, Armageddon for housing.
Should we be hedging against the stock market crash in the new year?
Absolutely. The odds are of a bear market in equities are very high. And the odds of a crash are reasonable, you know, let's say 60-40, something like that. So in that kind of an environment, you want to have some kind of protection. So it depends on your own temperament, what you consider that protection. It could just be cash. Just take a bunch of money out of, any kind of financial assets you have, stock funds, bond funds, whatever. Put them in a money market fund, or if you really trust your bank, put it in a bank account, although the banks are liable to be victims of what's coming. So I wouldn't put all your savings in any one, especially not a small bank. But anyhow, have cash somehow. That's protection. Or if you're a little more aggressive and you want serious turbocharged protection, then short the market. You can buy mutual funds that are designed to go up if the stock market goes down, and you can also buy put options. Like I'm adding to my portfolio of put options right now, which are generally long-term puts. Those are bets that the stock market is going to go down. I've got them against the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, and they've gotten crushed lately. But I'm continuing to add to them on the assumption that when the bear market does come, the most recent things I bought will go up 10 times, and the older things will at least go back to what I paid for them, and I'll end up making a lot of money, which I can put against my stock market losses. So those are some of the things you can do to hedge against an equities bear market. And I think everybody should be thinking about what their version of a hedge is right now, because equities are in serious trouble in the year ahead.
There's another mystery disease in China. Should people be concerned about another election year health emergency?
Think about the timing here. You know, the COVID pandemic hit in very early 2020, just as the establishment was looking at a Trump victory, which they really didn't want under any circumstances, and boom, out of nowhere comes this disease that locks the whole economy down and makes it impossible for Trump to campaign and puts the blame on him because he's the guy in charge. Well, it could easily be that another one comes along, but the establishment media shifts the blame over in a way that makes it harder for Trump to get reelected. or to get elected again, or any Republican, you know? So we'll see how this plays out, but I think the timing of it is very interesting because it was suspicious in 2020. Now it's a pattern if that thing happens. And yeah, you know, right now we don't know what the disease is in China. It sounds like pneumonia. You know, it sounds like a bacterial thing, but their hospitals are all clogged up with sick people and stuff. And, you know, I think we should just accept that that's the new normal for an incredibly crowded world. Mm-hmm. You take a city of 25 million people who are all jammed together. And how can you not incubate new diseases in that kind of an environment? It's like tailor-made for accelerating the mutation of microorganisms. So this is just it. This is the new normal. And the way you hedge against that, by the way, is you move to a farm. Get a homestead, all right, which is what we should all be looking at doing anyhow. If you're living on 10 acres and you're growing your own food, you don't have to interact with people during a pandemic. You just hang out with your garden, eat well, relax in the sun, and let the thing blow over. So there's the lifestyle to aspire to in this world. Be a gold bug, be a prepper in general, have some land.
I grew up on a homestead. There's no relaxation on a farm, let me tell you.
Yeah, that's why farmers have so many kids, because it's free labor, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And you feed them and put them to work. Yeah. You know, think of all the city people who are desperate for a farm job now, though. So you'll have no trouble getting cheap labor when the time comes.
Rightward political trends are gaining steam after elections in Argentina, the Netherlands. There's unrest in Ireland. Is a populist wave cresting?
Yeah, it is. I think you could make a solid case for the powers that be. The people who are in charge of most of the major countries right now are actively trying to destroy the culture of their countries in order to take a big crisis, or to make a big crisis that they can take advantage of by declaring martial law and basically imposing the rule of the aristocracy on everybody else. The risk that you take when you try that kind of a takeover is that people get so frustrated that they vote for populist candidates. Populism isn't actually a coherent political philosophy. It's more an attitude which says, look, a handful of super rich dirtbags are stealing everything you've got. You put me in power, I will take back what's yours from the dirtbags, and I'll put you in charge. So that's a, you know, without understanding the details of how it might work, that's a very attractive idea for a lot of people. So lots of populist candidates or quasi-populist candidates are either winning or doing very well in elections. Trump is one. Marine Le Pen in France keeps getting more and more popular. The what they call the far right, but it's really a populist country or party in Germany, is now the single most popular party. The Netherlands just elected right-wingers who are basically populist, and Argentina just elected a guy who is a cross between Ron Paul and Donald Trump. So we'll see how his tenure plays out, but he is totally going to stir things up. And this is just the beginning. If they actually, the aristocracy actually goes through with its plan to destroy the culture of major countries with open borders, incredibly easy money, and all the rest of the stuff that's going on now that should never have been put into place, then they're all going to be swept out of office. And then it's going to come down to, okay, do we allow ourselves to lose these elections, or do we just tell the army to keep us in power? And it wouldn't be a surprise if that happened in a lot of countries. So while the financial crisis is playing out, get ready for a political crisis of a scale never before seen, because it's global this time around, not just regional.
Now, New Zealand's former leftist government had a progressional ban on smoking tobacco products. So first of all, it's 21 years old, then 22, 23 to be able to legally possess tobacco. The right-wing government canceled that plan. They say it's because they need the tax revenue from smoking.
Well, yeah, that's That's what governments do when they start banning smoking. They get addicted. You know, their people aren't as addicted to smoking, but the governments are addicted to the revenues. And if you stamp out smoking, you realize that there's no more revenue, right? And then you have this hole in your budget you have to fill with some other really unpopular thing, like higher taxes or whatever. Mm. So, yeah, there's a mixed feelings about these kinds of social engineering laws once they're in place. So, New Zealand, I tell you what happened to the British Commonwealth? All the Commonwealth countries are going authoritarian one way or another. Australia and New Zealand were shockingly authoritarian during COVID, and they haven't stopped yet. And, sorry to say this, Jim, but Canada has done some shocking things lately. You know, Trudeau is, he looks like such a nice young boy. But he's got such authoritarian tendencies. So
he dyes his hair. He just looks young. He's not. He's the oldest guy out there. The Conservatives Trudeau? Used to run. Yes, he was gray before the election. He was very gray.
38 or something.
No,
how old is he?
Oh, a lot older than that. Now he dyes his hair and beard. Okay. If you look at older pictures of him, he was a gray beard. He was a silverback. And
what do you think of the theory that he's Fidel Castro's son?
Well, there's been enough opportunity to collect DNA that would have been popped out a long time ago. His mom singing praises of Castro and I don't know, other left-wing people from South America on a plane at some point. Yeah, an interesting life. How has the recent Middle East turmoil affected U.S. politics, and what does it mean for the upcoming elections in the U.S.?
Well, hopefully this is as bad as it gets with Israel and the Palestinians, and hopefully they come to some kind of an agreement that at least stops the bombing of children. I don't see any real solution in that part of the Middle East, because it's two traumatized cultures trying to live on the same land, and each feels existentially threatened. And when you're that threatened, you do extreme things. And so that's what we're seeing. Now, the danger is that the U.S. gets sucked into it, and we end up with a broader war where Iran and maybe Russia, maybe China are on one side, and the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia are on the other side, and missiles are flying, and that would be horrendous. So let's hope that that doesn't happen. But it does complicate U.S. elections, because we seem to have a rule here in the U.S. that you have to be rabidly, unquestioningly pro-Israel in order to win a national election. And so, but at the same time, the majority of young Americans are pro-Palestinian in this argument. So what do you do if you're a presidential candidate? You need the youth vote. You know, at least if you're a Democrat, you have to carry 70% of people under 30 years old, or you can't win. But you also have to be pro-Israel, which costs you a big chunk of the youth vote. So it's funny to watch these guys squirm, try to figure out how to kind of thread that needle, and I don't see how they do it. So I think that our election will be even more tempestuous because of this issue, because nobody knows exactly what they should be saying, but they all know they have to say some things in a really definite way. So, it'll be fascinating to watch. But I tell you what, I think we have a three-way horse race in the U.S. right now. I think if the election was held today, it might be an even split between Trump and Kennedy and Biden, which is pretty shocking, and it makes it very volatile, because what happens when there are debates and things like that. So I'm looking forward to the political theater, but I'm afraid we end up with another contested election when people are calling out the National Guard and stuff to keep them in office. So let's hope that doesn't happen.
Would the Democrats attract the youth vote if they said they would legalize marijuana federally, something that Joe Biden's against?
Yeah, the Democrats have some issues. Abortion is a huge one, because now abortion is a state-by-state issue, which means every election is consequential. And that's a major young person liberal issue. So it's maybe 60-40 favoring the Democrats on the abortion issue. And weed is another issue that it doesn't seem to have the passion as that abortion in Israel do, but it's still something that it's a regional thing. You know, it doesn't favor Democrats across the board, but in any liberal state, it definitely favors them. And in most of the swing states, it's helpful, but it's not good in the Deep South, obviously. So that's a trickier issue. And I think that's one where politicians can just be honest, just say what they think, you know, because it's not a make or break thing for anybody. Whereas abortion can be, Israel absolutely is, so is immigration, one way or the other. You know, you either to get the liberal vote, you pretty much have to be open borders, and to get the moderate and conservative vote, you have to be closed borders, no questions asked. So you know, we have to divide along these lines, and there are a few things where it's questionable. That's what makes it interesting this time around.
Yeah, well, it's made Canada interesting. A million migrants entered the country last year. Our unemployment is up, and it's blamed on those migrants not being able to find jobs. And they can't find places to live either. We're short like something like 3.3 million homes.
Yeah, Canada has an interesting demographic profile because your population is aging, which means you need more young people in order to support the old people. You could cut pension benefits right away and solve that problem, but assuming you're not going to do that, you need young people somehow. And Canada's done a pretty good job of importing people with skills and money. You know, you get the people coming who want to buy a Vancouver condo, and so they toss $3 million Canadian dollars at you right up front. You know, that's not like what's happening in the U.S. But there's still a limit. You can't have a country if it's completely swamped by people from different cultures, because then the culture goes away, and then you have a civil war over what your culture is. And Canada's, you know, you're headed that way. So are we. I think the only solution for the U.S. is to lock the border down for the next 10 years, and then find all the people that came through illegally in the last 3 years, round them up, dump them back into Mexico, and start over. And that's going to be an incredibly messy prospect. You guys aren't in that situation yet, but you still have to do something, because you can't have the same number of migrants coming in year after year that you've had in the last couple of years. You've got to get control over it. So we'll see, you know, if there's the political will there to do that. Your conservative guy talks a good game. I don't know if he'll do it once he's in office, but it sounds like he's running on something like relatively secure borders.
Should people hold off buying an e-bike if they were planning to put one under the Christmas tree for somebody and perhaps just give them, I owe you one?
Well, you know, the bike industry is in a really interesting situation, because during the pandemic, biking was one of the things you could do that was virtuous. So everybody went out and bought bikes. So the bike manufacturers had to expand their productive capacity in order to satisfy that new demand and hire all the people and everything. And then the minute the pandemic ended, bike demand just dried up. You know, now you can, if you do need a bike, you can go buy a used one on eBay for half price. So bike shops and the bike manufacturers are really hurting. And I just bought today an e-bike for one-third off the manufacturer's suggested retail price. And the guy at the bike shop was telling me that some categories of bikes have been marked down by 80%. Mm. So, and a lot of those were kids' bikes. So if you're thinking of buying your kid a bike, jump on it right now. Now, if you want an e-bike, you know, is one-third off enough of an incentive? Even though it might be a little lower later on, but I think one-third off for a brand-new, high-quality, brand-name e-bike is pretty good, you know? So I got one, and over the next few weeks, I'm going to be researching for the spring, those big long Canadian bike rides that you guys have up there, and see if, you know, see if I can't do a 200-mile ride on my new e-bike. So I'll let you know how it goes.
Vancouver to Whistler is nice.
Oh, that sounds awesome. You know, and I don't even care if there are hills now because my e-bike can handle it.
Or so, yeah. From Port Angeles, how about Chuckanut Drive in the springtime and check out all the tulips? That's a beautiful drive.
Even though I live there, I don't know Chuckanut Drive, so I'll check it out for sure.
Yeah, it's just south of the Canadian border, and it wanders around. There's beautiful restaurants and pubs where you can get great meals and just acres and acres of tulips of every nature in the springtime.
Is that on the mainland up north of
Seattle? Yes, it is. Yes,
okay.
It is. North of Seattle.
That's easy. I'll do that.
John,
thanks, Jim.
Yeah, well, the uncle, I have lots of relatives in Seattle. So, yeah, he took us on a tour. It was great. Where can people follow you?
I'm at rubino.substack.com, and I'm doing a lot of actionable stuff lately. So junior gold and silver mining stocks, techniques for sorting the market, stuff like that. So come over, get a free subscription for a while, check things out, and see if you want to go by behind the paywall after that.
John, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thanks, Jim.
My guest has been John Rubino, author of several books on the economy, including The Money Bubble. Find him on Substack at rubino.substack.com. Coming up, Wolf Richter, next on This Week in Money.
Recyclico, making lithium-ion last forever. Recyclico's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclico Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
This Week in Money is archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com.
Welcome back. My guest is Wolf Richter, publisher of wolfstreet.com. He's speaking to us from San Francisco. Welcome back to This Week in Money.
Thanks for having me back, Jim.
Can you tell us a little bit about Wolf Street?
Wolfstreet.com is about business, finance, and money. We are free. There's no paywall. You don't have to sign up for anything, and it's without getting involved in partisan politics. So just essentially business, finance, and money, and we have a vibrant commenting section.
Loan loss provisions are increasing at banks in Canada. Are we seeing the same thing happen in the U.S., and is it the canary in the coal mine for real estate and the economy?
Yeah, so in terms of the loss provisions, they actually ticked down a little bit in this last quarter. But the real issue with losses is in commercial real estate, and they're huge there, and they're just working their way through the system. But so far, the biggest losses have been spread across investors, not banks. So the banks are involved too, but the worst sections of that, so office and retail. Retail has been bad for many years, and office has gone bad the last couple of years. And they're heavily funded by investors, these loans, and so these are commercial mortgage-backed securities and property REITs and mortgage REITs and so forth. And so investors are mostly taking those losses, and banks have been taking some losses, but they're spared the biggest bloodletting so far. In terms of residential, it still looks pretty good. We have dropping home prices, but they've shot up so far that homeowners can easily sell their homes and pay off the mortgage with the proceeds. So we have not seen a big increase in foreclosures. We have seen only minuscule increases in delinquencies, so on mortgages. So it's not the residential sector that's getting in trouble. It's the commercial. And And there, it's investors that are largely on the hook so far. And it seems like that's my theory here, is that the worst, most riskiest loans were sold by banks to investors, essentially securitizing them or selling them off to mortgage REITs and private equity firms and others that get into that, and that they retain some of the less risky loans. And so they really have not been hit by that bloodletting that is going on in commercial real estate right now.
Is quantitative easing continuing?
Yes, it's continuing. It's continuing. I'm sorry. Quantitative easing? No. I thought you said quantitative tightening.
Yeah.
Tightening. No, quantitative easing is over. It's gone. All the major central banks have essentially gone the opposite way into quantitative tightening. Japan is a little bit of a laggard, but they backed away from quantitative easing as well, and they no longer do it. So both the Fed and the Bank of Canada, to stick with us here in North America, they have unloaded substantial portions of the balance sheet, so that's quantitative tightening. The European Central Bank, which is a huge central bank, it has unloaded its balance sheet by huge amounts as well. So quantitative tightening is the rule, and QE is essentially out the window, and I don't see it coming back.
Are U.S. consumers still spending like inebriated mariners?
Our drunken sailors terminology here that I coined a year ago. I didn't really coin the term, but I applied it to consumers because it was just so astonishing what's happening in the United States with these consumers. And they're not really behaving like drunken sailors. So we got sort of a facetious expression that I use to describe the spending behavior. But they're pretty rational about this. There's a record number of people working. They're making record amounts of money. They've gotten the biggest pay raises in 40 years, and they've gotten those pay raises last year. And so this year, they're spending those pay raises that were given last year. And the retirees got the biggest cost of living adjustment in Social Security payments in 40 years. So they got 8.7%. cost of living adjustments for this year, and these people are spending most of the money that they get. So retirees, fixed income people, when they get a little extra money, they spend it. It's not for savings. They're in the spending phase of their lives, and so the Social Security increases, most of that flows essentially directly back into consumer spending. Then we have the many trillions of dollars that consumers have in their pile of assets that are fairly liquid or totally liquid. And right now, consumers have bought $3 trillion U.S. dollars worth of certificates of deposits. They've bought into money market funds, so there's about $6 trillion in money market funds. They've bought into treasury bills, lots of them. And all these investments are now returning 5.5% roughly, compared to near 0% 2 years ago. And each $1 trillion that you get 5.5% on, that's $55 billion a year that's flowing back to the consumers, and they're spending some of this income now that they're getting from these liquid assets. And so all of this has been supporting consumer spending, and I mean, sure, there are some troubles in the subprime sector, but it's a small part of consumption, and the rest of it, it's just amazing how consumers have been navigating these higher interest rates in terms of their spending patterns, and it astonished me all year, and they just refused to back off.
Are we ever going to get a break when buying a car after the run-up in prices?
Yeah, so that's happening now, and I'm really happy to see that. We had these just extraordinary price increases in 2020 and 2021, especially in used cars, but also in new cars. And it was just a complete rip-off atmosphere back then, and consumers played along. You know, they paid whatever, and they were willing to buy vehicles when they could have driven what they still have. And so they jumped on this. And this caused especially used vehicle prices to spike. So they were up at the peak about 55% at the end of 2021 before they had been 2 years earlier. And this is just nuts. So now wholesale prices have been coming down since their peak at the end of 2021. Retail prices have come down both in the 12 to 15% range so far for used vehicles. And this continues. So it's sort of wobbling up and down, but it clearly shows the downward trend. Dealers are buying at the auction. They're paying less for these vehicles. Consumers are now aware that they can get deals, and they're being more careful with how much money they're spending, and they're negotiating a little bit more. So they're going back to their old habits of not just buying what's there. And that's putting downward pricing pressures on the market, and it's fairly consistent in the used vehicle market. We have seen that, and it seems to continue. I don't think that the whole price spike will be worked off, but right now we're down about a third of the price spike, so about a third of the price spike was taken off so far, and we're going to continue down a little bit further. I don't know how far, maybe half will be taken off, maybe a little more than half, but I doubt it can go back all the way to what prices were in 2020. That seems to be unrealistic, but I think there's room left, and these extraordinary price increases that we've seen are over. I think consumers need to be very careful when they shop for cars. They need to be astute like they used to be. They need to pay attention. They need to shop around. There's plenty of inventory now. There's no shortage of cars, and consumers need to be just really alert. In the new vehicle segment, what we have seen back then in 2021 and also still in 2022 were these addendum stickers where dealers sold cars over MSRP, and that to me is just outrageous. Consumers should just walk out when they see that. They should not do business with anybody that's selling a vehicle over MSRP, and that has now stopped. And not only that, but now there are big discounts on vehicles. Some of them, many of them, come from the automakers themselves. There's plenty of inventory now for most models. There's lots to choose from in trucks and SUVs. There's a few models that are short in supply, but most of it is in ample supply. And automakers have national programs out with big rebates and cash back and all kinds of stuff. And dealers have their own discounts. So it is really important to shop around. You can see these price drops on the internet, these discounts. Instead of putting a $20,000 addendum sticker on MSRP on a pickup truck, you see a $15,000 discount now. So this is a huge swing from what it looked like 2 years ago. And this will likely continue overall in terms of our consumer price index. New vehicle prices have really not come down. They have plateaued for about 10 months now. And that's strange because used vehicle prices have come down pretty hard in our CPI, but new vehicle prices have not moved down, and they have plateaued. But I see the discounts working their way into the system. Tesla's price cuts are helping big time to get prices down. And for consumers right now, this is still not a very good time to buy a car. But if you're out there buying, look for deals. There are deals available. There are plenty of vehicles in inventory, and you should be able to make some kind of a deal when you go shopping.
How are EV sales doing?
Oh, they're doing pretty good. They're growing in leaps and bounds. Obviously, there's huge volume now out there, and so the penetration is pretty big. And the growth rates in terms of exploding, they're going down a little bit. I mean, there were some startups that had growth rates of 100% year over year because they were at a very small volume, and now they're doing much higher volume, so the growth rates are down 30 or 50. Are still 30 or 50%, but they're not 100% anymore. So we're seeing some of that. They're now a big part of what's being sold. They're doing very well, and the price cuts are helping. I'm hoping that there will be more price cuts. EVs should be cheaper than internal combustion engine vehicles. They're easier to build, and Tesla has figured that out, and other EV makers are now jumping on that. Obviously, Ford and GM and other legacy automakers have sort of gotten run over by Tesla at this and by the other specialized EV makers, and they're kind of pulling back because they never expected to see price cuts. They figured we're going to do with these EVs what we're doing with pickup trucks, which is we sell them at huge prices, at huge markups. We're going to make $25,000, $30,000 a vehicle on these in gross profits. And that's not happening. Tesla X that out and with its price cuts. So now they don't have the supply chain in order, and they don't have the production method and designs in order to compete with Tesla on price. So they're getting killed out there. GM doesn't have anything. It has to bolt that it, the model discontinued this year. And the other stuff is in the announcement phase. Ford has a pickup truck that's not very competitive, and it has an SUV, a compact SUV. It's way overpriced, and it's losing money on them. It can't cut prices, and Tesla is outselling them by huge leaps. So the legacy automakers have just completely dropped the ball, and now they're doing share buybacks, and they're doing all these crazy things to keep their stock price up, and they're spending billions of dollars on these share buybacks instead of investing in the EV future. They've just gotten run over by a Tesla on autopilot, I think.
How are home builders approaching the housing market in this interest rate environment?
Yeah, so that's interesting to see because homeowners, so people that own a home, they have not come to grips with reality here in the United States, and they're putting their homes on the market at high prices that for which there are no buyers. So our sales have collapsed, and they're down by 35%, something like that, of existing homes, and from a couple of years ago. And so home builders can't do that. They have to build, and they have to sell homes no matter what. And it doesn't matter what interest rates are. It doesn't matter what anything else is. That's the business they've got to build and they've got to sell. And so they have changed strategy. So they're building at lower price points. So they're building smaller homes. They're building fewer amenities into their homes, so they're getting less fancy in these homes. So they've also seen some of the costs of materials come down, so that's helping their cost basis. The labor costs gone up, but their material costs have gone down from the spike a couple of years ago. And so they're offering lower priced homes. So the median price of new homes sold in the United States has come down by 18% from the peak couple of years ago and a year ago, and that's a pretty significant drop, and most of that is due to home builders offering lower price points, building homes that they can offer at lower price points. And home builders are doing other strategies. Primarily they're buying down mortgage rates, and that is an expensive strategy. So when the market mortgage rate is 7.3% for our classic 30-year fixed rate mortgage, then they might buy down to 5.9% or something like that. And and they have their own mortgage company, so they can do that more easily. They're the ones that issue the mortgage, but it costs money to do that. And so it's an incentive, an expensive incentive, but it's a very effective incentive, and home sales have actually, so new sales of new houses have actually held up pretty well, whereas sales of existing houses have plunged. So home builders are doing all the right things. They're cutting their prices, they're cutting the size of the homes they're offering, they're cutting the amenities, they're buying down the mortgage rates, so another incentive's added. So they're able to maintain a pretty decent home sales volume at substantially lower prices.
Are the inflation numbers and the real rate of inflation in the U.S. finally moving in the right direction?
Yeah, so we're seeing interesting things happening here. Obviously, energy prices, like everywhere, have plunged last month. Gasoline prices have plunged. And so that's pulling down the headline figures. And then we've seen durable goods prices come down. So we've just talked about cars, used vehicles, new vehicles. The same thing is happening with electronics and some other products that are part of durable goods. So durable goods prices overall have come down month to month and year over year. They had spiked during the shortages, so now they're working off some of that spike. And that causes some of the core inflation numbers to be lower. And, of course, durable goods prices can't drop forever. They're now working off the spike that they had, and at some point they stopped dropping and they start rising again. And but right now they're in this phase where they're working off that spike, and so we see the prices actually come down, and that's good to see. So this energy price drop and the drop in durable goods prices is really helping get these inflation numbers down. On the other hand, food prices are continuing to rise, and that's a problem because they're very, very, very high. And for low-income people, they're spending a big portion of the income on food, and they spiked, and they have not come down. So they plateaued for a little while, and now they're rising again. So that's very disconcerting. And housing rents in the United States, there's still red-hot inflation in the housing sector. It's over 6%. It's not as bad as it was anymore, but it seems to now get hung up in that 6% range, and that's very high. And so other services also have this issue of not following the declines we see elsewhere, and there are some hot spots in services that are very difficult to deal with. So right now, inflation has come down a lot. We used to have inflation in the 9% range, CPI, and a couple of years ago, we're down half of that. We're going a little lower than that. But the underlying portion of it shows that inflation continues. Now it's no longer in goods. It's shifted away from durable goods where it was really big. It's now in services, and it's not as hot in services as it was, but it's still pretty hot, and it's tough to get rid of. It just hangs in there, and there's one service that goes down a little bit, and there's another one that spikes in. So we have this underlying issue in our services inflation, and services, that's over 60% of what consumers spent the money on. So this is a really important thing to watch. And you can not buy a used car for a while, but you can't be without insurance, and you can't be without housing and so forth. So these services are often essentials. And when prices rise, people still have to pay for them. And that's why inflation is so tough to get rid of there. And consumers have gotten big pay increases. So landlords know that too. They know consumers are making 5% more than a year ago, and so 6% more. And if you had a monthly income of $4,000 and you have an increase of 5%, so that's $200. But at the same time, if you spend half your income on rent, you can actually spend that whole entire $2 on a rent increase. And that's what's happening. That's why rents increase faster than pay increases, and they're getting away with it. So this is the big landlords have confirmed that the big national landlords, that they're getting rent increases in that 6% range on renewals and on new lease signings. So this is just, this rent inflation is just going to dog us for a long time, I think.
The U.S. says its GDP went up 5.6% in the third quarter. In Canada, it went down 1.1% during the same time period. What do those numbers tell us?
Well, the United States is not used to those kinds of growth rates. Our average GDP growth rate over the past 10 years or so is just below 2%. So this third quarter spike in GDP was sort of a freak thing. And I expected it, actually, the first estimate came out at 4.9%. I expected it to be downwardly revised. It was upwardly revised yesterday to over 5%. So that cannot last. That's just not possible. We are going to have a much lower GDP growth rate in the fourth quarter. So I think if we get 2%, that'll be pretty good. But the economy is strong, and that's just that's what the third quarter showed. You have consumer spending like drunken sailors. You have the U.S. government borrowing and spending like drunken sailors. So they're the worst about that. And our deficit spending at the federal government level is just completely out of control. And our debt keeps ballooning. That money, when the government spends, it gets plowed into the economy. And that's stimulative. That stimulates the economy. It stimulates inflation. And so it's really hard to see this economy slow down with this government of borrowing like this and spending. Businesses have spent, there's lots of construction going on and in all different sectors, and their factories are being built at record rates. And so it's been an amazingly strong economy here. Now, the data's coming out of Canada is very different, and we don't see that kind of strength in Canada right now. And Canada is more in line with the European data we're seeing, and which is also weakening. So, you know, they're running on different dancing for different drummers, so to speak. Everybody expected the U.S. economy to slow down. That was a year ago that we expected that, and it just hasn't. It just hasn't slowed down. It there's no recession in sight. It keeps plugging along, and sometimes higher and sometimes lower growth rates. And there's a substantial slowdown going on in Canada. We're not seeing that here. So, it'd be interesting to see whether they come back in line. It could be that in Canada, too, it's a kind of a fluke, a short-term thing, and growth will start picking up again. I don't know if that works. Your housing sector's got hit a lot harder, and your economy is dependent on that housing sector a lot more than in the United States. So that is one factor, and probably a pretty important factor. And another factor is a lot of the manufacturing and tech industry in the United States, that they're doing pretty well. And it's astonishing how well the U.S. economy has held up.
Does it look like the price of lithium could be bottoming?
Yeah, so that spike was ridiculous, and it peaked a year ago, and it's just completely come back down from that. And lithium, obviously, is a big topic with EVs. They're using a lot of it for the batteries, but the spike last year was due to hype and hoopla about shortages. There is no shortage in lithium. Lithium is plentiful. It's all over the world. There's a ton of it in the United States. It's just not getting mined, but they're starting to. And so in all these commodities, when the price spikes, you see a lot of money piling into production, and then there's more production, and more mines come online and other methods of production in the United States. We're looking at producing lithium out of brine that's coming deep up from underground, and we have some of that brine coming up already from our geothermal plants, and they're lithium rich, so they can be used to extract lithium from. And so that's a project in Arkansas that Exxon is doing that's based on a similar technology. So that's not really mining it, but getting it out of the brine that's coming up from deep, up from the earth. And obviously these are projects that take a long time to get online, but there's others that were almost ready. They're now online, and production can be increased in mines. And so there's no shortage. Now there's a glut. And now we have this additional technology coming along that promises to produce batteries without lithium or less lithium, And that could be a problem for the lithium industry when the battery technology changes over to some other material. And of course, that creates all kinds of other issues somewhere else. But that's how the commodity sector works, and that's why we have these huge spikes and plunges, and that's just part of it.
Where's the best place for people to follow you?
WallStreet.com. Everything's free, no paywall, nothing to sign up. So the site is supported by donations and ads. So please come check us out, WallStreet.com.
Wolf, thank you so much for being on This Week in Money.
Thank you.
My guest has been Wolf Richter, publisher of WolfStreet.com. He was speaking to us from San Francisco. And that wraps up our show for this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Ross Clark, John Rubino, and Wolf Richter. And thank you for listening. If you have any questions for the show or for our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. I'm Jim Goddard. We'll be back next week with more This Week in Money.
Comments made on This Week in Money are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any manner whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Archived online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. This Week in Money is a production of How Street Media Incorporated. Executive producer is Tom Allen.